The weather and climate often cause concern and curiosity, but understanding the facts behind the phenomena can be a challenge. We're here to help. From the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Illinois Public Media, welcome to Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the skies above Illinois and the world. I'm your host, Maddie Stover, a doctoral student in physics here at the University of Illinois.
And I'm Steve Nesbitt, professor of climate, meteorology, and atmospheric sciences at the University of Illinois.
So Steve, what is the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences?
Yeah, you may not have heard of our department because it's relatively new in terms of the name, but we've been around since 1982 as the Department of Atmospheric Sciences. We renamed our department recently in 2023 to capture more of the breadth of what we do. We could do climate change, research into weather and weather disasters, and also studying our atmosphere in terms of what it's made of and how it impacts people. So we cover not only just the hard sciences, predicting the weather, how climate's going to change, but also how it's going to impact people.
What do you focus on in your research as a professor?
Yeah, so I do everything that falls out of the sky. So whether it be rain, snow, hail, I study what's called hydrometeors. These are particles that form in clouds and fall out. Obviously, these are important for society because they help us as humans survive, but also in terms of high impact weather, heavy rainfall, the formation of hail, and the formation of snow. Obviously, these are things that are very impactful. And so we work on everything from developing the models that predict those things and the weather timescale, but also how those processes are represented in climate models to help us predict how climate is going to change in the future.
And you go out into the field as well, right? Like you did some work in Chicago previously and...
Yeah, we've done field campaigns. I think I've done 24 field campaigns in my career. We basically do all the tools of the trade in terms of weather balloons, radars, things we can take out on the ground. We've done things to validate satellite measurements, and we also run models to try to understand whether we can represent what we observe in the field correctly within forecast models. So sort of a direct way to improve how we do weather and climate prediction.
So this is our first show. We scientists wanted to get together to sort of demystify some of the common questions and concerns around weather and climate.
Yeah, so those of us who study meteorology in Illinois are just people that live here just like you. We ask the same questions that you do about why our climate can be so extreme and why we get these storms on days that we might not expect them to be so severe. So we wanted to get this podcast together so that we can better communicate what we understand, what we don't understand about Illinois weather and climate. Climate change is a reality that we're all going to face, and so we all need to take steps to make sure that we're doing what we can to educate people about how the weather and climate works here in the state.
So Steve, if you could tell the listeners a little bit about why we chose the name Weather Realness for the show.
So I'm a Gen Xer, and we like to get real. That's what we used to say back in the day. So we're here to give you the straight-up facts about weather and climate. No spin. We're going to take all the data and evidence that we have at our fingertips and share it with you as a listener. Also going to get to a level where hopefully people can engage and ask us great questions about what you're curious about here in the weather and climate in the state.
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely want to hear from you. We want to be able to best answer your questions and kind of the concerns that are on the top of your mind. We start by taking you back to a scorching summer 30 years ago, to the historic July 1995 heat wave in Chicago.
This is Chicago's News.
Tonight, we examine one of the deadliest disasters in Chicago's history.
Thursday, and the heat began to get our attention. 106 degrees, a new record. The open hydrants cause water pressure to drop throughout the city, and 23 cooling centers are forced to close. The bodies started coming Friday evening. By Saturday, the Cook County morgue was overflowing. Refrigerated trucks had to be brought in to store the dead.
When the heat and humidity combine for a heat index of 105, a heat emergency is declared. Today at Midway Airport, it reached 110.
Chicago is under a heat emergency as people endure another day of stifling temperatures. It's all happening exactly 1 month to the day a record oppressive heat claimed more lives than the Chicago fire.
To learn more about this heat wave, we are joined by social scientist Dr. Aaron Klinenberg, director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. Dr. Klinenberg is the author of Heat Wave, a social autopsy of a disaster in Chicago, which analyzes the 1995 Chicago heat wave. Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Eric, can you describe the July 1995 Chicago heat wave? Take us back to that time.
Well, everybody who lives in Illinois is used to heat and probably have some very uncomfortable days in our memory. But 1995 was another level altogether. It wasn't just that it was extraordinarily hot and the peak temperature hit about 106 degrees in the city of Chicago. It was also unusually humid, so that the real feel, the heat index, got to 126 degrees. And Chicago is a heat island. Cities tend to be heat islands. They attract the heat with all the steel and concrete pavement, and then they trap the heat with all the pollution. And so the other thing that made it a really difficult time meteorologically is that it just didn't cool down much at night. So for a series of days, you got no natural relief if you lived in Chicago. And, you know, inevitably in the big city, as everybody tries to deal with the heat with air conditioning, the power winds up going out. And so at this time when it was dangerously hot, uncomfortably and dangerously humid, hundreds of thousands of people also lost their power, some for a couple of days. And we really saw in 1995 the formula for disaster.
So how many people actually passed away as a result of the heat wave?
Well, the best evidence we have, which are the excess death figures from the week of July 14th to July 20th, 1995, tell us that about 739 people in excess of the norm died.
Who were these people? Was there a typical victim?
People most at risk were older people. They were people who were disproportionately poor, didn't have access to air conditioning. They tended to live in the most segregated Black neighborhoods in the city of Chicago. And they were also socially isolated. They were people who did not have strong contacts with family members, with friends, with neighbors. Older people living alone who were frail were especially at risk. And so in the book I wrote, I really tried to pinpoint why some people in some places were so much more vulnerable than others.
So taking us back to the mid-90s, obviously this is before smartphone era, before social media. So communication was a lot different. And of course, our disaster responses were probably a lot different as well. Could you speak about how the city responded to this event in real time? And do you feel that people knew enough what to do during this situation?
Well, they most definitely did not know what to do in the situation. If you go back 30 years, there wasn't really much sensitivity to the problem of global warming. Some people were worried about it, but it's not the kind of national or international issue it is right now. And there was much less concern about heat as a public health issue in most quarters. And so the heat came announced. Forecasters could see this unusual weather system coming for days in advance of the time it hit Illinois. In fact, as it moved through the country, hundreds of thousands of animals died of heat. And, you know, if it were a hurricane, we would have expected the weather channels, the meteorologists to track the storm as it moved through the country. You know, we do this routinely, but we don't do that with the heat. And we certainly didn't do it in 1995. So when the heat arrived in Illinois and when it arrived in Chicago, you know, the mayor, several of the key members of his cabinet, the fire commissioner, the health commissioner, they were on vacation. As a matter of fact, the city of Chicago had a heat emergency plan that it had developed before 1995, having learned from quite lethal heat waves in St. Louis and Philadelphia. But shockingly, people at the health department forgot that they had developed a heat emergency plan, and so no one activated it. The city never really issued a heat emergency until it was far too late, and didn't do the quite substantial range of things that it could do to try to signal alerts to everyone in the city. That meant that the media, instead of talking about health concerns, were dueling with meteorologists in Phoenix to see who could fry an egg on the street more quickly. There were lots of light features in the newspaper about how to handle, your makeup on hot days, what to do to take care of your horse. Of course, the expected article about the race to buy air conditioners and department stores. But if you go back and look at the coverage, you see a city that is in no way seriously prepared for what was coming.
So that probably delayed the opening of cool centers and other things that might have been available for residents that we might take advantage of today.
Well, there are a number of things. First, you really do want to spread the word that heat can be dangerous and urge people and organizations to check in on their neighbors and loved ones. That didn't happen because people weren't talking about the health risks. You have lots of service workers, including, people who do home care, deliver meals on wheels, work with older people, community police officers who could be activated in an emergency to knock on doors and to make phone calls, to check in on vulnerable people. The city did none of that. You could issue an emergency so that outlying suburban areas that have ambulances and paramedics can divert them to the city of Chicago in a crisis. You can have a system for monitoring hospital emergency room intake, so you can make sure that if a hospital is filled to capacity and they can't take new emergency patients, the ambulance drivers know where to take someone so they can get quick relief. The city, again, did not do any of those things. And in fact, when the mayor first came back to the city and started talking about what was going on, and instead of treating it like a real public health crisis, he treated it like a public relations crisis. And he said, people were covering this as talking about it in a way that was out of proportion. The Commissioner of Human Services said, people were dying because they neglected to take care of themselves.
So you alluded to a couple things that could have been done. What changes since 1995, what changes did the city of Chicago make to protect its residents from future extreme heat?
Well, there are a lot of emergency things you can do in a heat wave that make a difference, and the city has done a lot of them. So, for instance, everyone now treats the heat as a serious health issue. We get those public health warnings. The city works more closely with media to make sure that there are announcements and everyone knows to check in on their friends and neighbors, and that helps quite a lot. The city has deployed service workers to call or knock on doors and check in with people when dangerous weather arrives. You mentioned cooling centers before. Cooling centers tend not to be all that popular if it's like opening up a high school gymnasium somewhere, because no one wants to spend the day sitting in an empty gymnasium. If you turn a branch library into a cooling center, that works a lot better. If you can do something to provide transit for people, that works a lot better. So they've made improvements on those scores too. But one of my concerns is that we haven't done enough to cool down cities in this climate changed era we live in. So it's now getting hotter for longer, and we're seeing more dangerous heat waves. And it's not at all clear that we've done enough to create green space, to provide shade, to have the kind of level of green roofs and community gardens that we could use to bring down the temperature. Certainly haven't done enough to stop burning fossil fuels, so we don't have a break on the processes that are making the earth hotter. And then there's still this underlying problem, which is that our cities are still very segregated, very unequal. We have more older people who are living alone and aging alone than ever before. And so there's some sociological reasons why heat waves are more dangerous. And my concern today is that, it's just a matter of time before we get another truly dangerous weather system, and Chicago will not be prepared.
For For those just tuning in, you're listening to Weather Realness, a new podcast from the University of Illinois Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences and Illinois Public Media. Each week, scientists are answering questions about weather and climate. I'm Maddie Stover, a doctoral student in physics here at the U of I.
And I'm Steve Nesbitt, professor of climate, meteorology, and atmospheric science at the University of Illinois.
Do you have a weather or climate question you want answered by Illinois leading scientists? Leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141. Again, 217-333-2141. We may answer your question on the next Weather Realness. On our first show, we're talking about the deadly Chicago heat wave of 1995 and what changed in policy to prevent more deaths in the future. Right now, Steve and I are talking with Eric Klinenberg, social scientist, author, and expert on Chicago heat waves.
So yeah, I've done some work in the South Side, and in particular, some of the neighborhoods like Chatham have seen a lot of decrease in their tree cover due to various, you know, tree diseases. And the city is aware of this, and they're trying to make inroads. But apart from changing the landscape, what are some innovative things that cities and communities can be doing to keep people safe during high temperatures?
Well, first, I want to say, especially if you're thinking about, you know, Chicago and the South Side or the West Side, when there's lots of empty lots and abandoned properties, it's actually not very expensive to convert them into community gardens that have more green space and that also provide occasion for people across generations to work with each other outside, to get to know each other, to build relationships. And that matters because, again, social isolation is such a big risk factor for heat deaths. And if you create things that keep people connected and help to build social cohesion on a daily basis, then when you've got a crisis, you can activate those support networks and people are just much less likely to be discovered at home on their own.
How can cities deal with the high energy demands of extreme heat?
Well, it's very hard to deal with the high energy demands of extreme heat because we consume a lot of energy on a daily basis. You know, it's not just our air conditioners, it's our mobile phones, our laptop computers, our flat screen TVs, the AI that we're now, you know, using even when we don't mean to. I mean, we have become massive consumers of energy and it's hard to get people to stop. You know, in some cities on very hot days, the authorities make public pleas to ask people to reduce their consumption, make sure the lights are off, don't air condition places that you're not spending time in, you know, maybe unplug some things from the walls. But those are last ditch and desperate measures. And again, they're hard to pull off because if it's dangerously hot, people really want to be cranking up that AC and making sure it's as cool as possible indoors. I guess that means another big challenge for cities is making sure that they have, you know, updated electrical grids and are doing everything possible to make them resilient and to make sure that they can handle large demand. We have been doing that increasingly by getting more renewable energy sources online. And in this political climate, I worry a lot about the capacity of states to continue those investments, given the political winds. So this is a real challenge, you know, dealing with the extreme heat in a climate change world that's organized around inequality. This is not an easy thing to do. And I guess I don't want to say that there's simple answers, but I do want us to ask the hard questions.
Steve and I are talking with Eric Klinenberg, social scientist, author, and expert on Chicago heat waves. Eric, thank you again for joining us. You're listening to Weather Realness, a new podcast from the University of Illinois Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences and Illinois Public Media. Each week, scientists are answering questions about weather and climate. I'm Maddie Stover, a doctoral student in physics here at the U of I.
And I'm Steve Nesbitt, professor of climate, meteorology, and atmospheric science at the University of Illinois.
Do you have a weather or climate question you want answered by Illinois leading scientists? Leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141. Again, 217-333-2141. We may answer your question on the next Weather Realness. On our first show, we're talking about the deadly Chicago heat wave of 1995 and what changed in policy to prevent more deaths in the future. To learn about the weather conditions that brought about this heat wave, we are joined by Dr. Kenneth Kunkel, Principal Research Scholar at North Carolina Institute for Climate Studies. Ken is a native of Illinois and worked for many years at the Prairie Research Institute at the University of Illinois. Ken, thank you for being here.
No, happy to be here.
Ken, generally speaking, can you define what a heat wave is?
Well, there's a number of definitions that are out there that research scientists use for defining heat waves. And there's no clear single definition that fits all cases. Usually the National Weather Service offices have their own metrics for a heat wave. Typically in Illinois, unless things have changed since I left, a heat warning would be issued when the heat index reaches 105 degrees or is forecast to reach 105 degrees. So that's one metric that's used in the Midwest for identifying a heat wave.
Ken, can you give us a quick synopsis of what happened weather-wise to cause this particular event?
Yes, I can. Primary cause was what's now referred to in the media as the development of a heat dome, an upper-level high-pressure system that is caused by sinking air in the atmosphere. As it sinks, it warms, compresses. So this is what was happening in early July. The heat wave, this particular upper-level high-pressure system, developed over the Rocky Mountains and then moved eastward and eventually moved across the entire country. That was a very intense upper-level high and centered just about over Illinois during the middle of the intense heat. The other key factor for this particular heat wave, as Eric pointed out, were the high humidity levels. And in fact, one of the metrics we use in the atmospheric science world to define the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere is the dew point temperature. A number of locations, including in the Chicago area, a number of locations around the Midwest set all-time records for highest dew point temperature. And so this wasn't just an ordinary Midwest, warm, sultry day. This was a truly intense situation with much danger to human health.
So during that event, one thing that was pretty striking was the low temperatures were very high. And of course, this is something that we're seeing as a trend in climate change, is that the minimum temperatures sometimes don't really get that low at night. Can you talk about some of the factors that caused the lows not to go very low during this event?
Yeah, in fact, the main factor is the amount of humidity in the air. That sort of puts a lower limit on how low the temperature can get at night. And the dew point temperature is a good metric for that in the Midwest during a heat wave. It just won't get lower than that. So the kinds of dew point temperatures that we were talking about then were in the upper 70s or low 80s. And so the air temperature will basically stop when it gets to about that point. So it was really primarily due to the humidity.
And then what weather factors brought this heat wave to an end?
Well, the upper level high moved from the Rockies across the Midwest, and it just continued to move. It moved over into the eastern part of the country, and it also gave them heat wave conditions on the East Coast, although not historically as severe as happened in the upper Midwest. And a weak front slowly moved down from Canada across the upper Midwest. And finally, on the 16th, it put an end to the excessive heat.
So you played a pretty active role in sort of the post-storm analysis of this particular event. Can you tell us kind of a summary of what you learned based on studying this event in terms of how heat waves work?
I think the big thing I learned was in our analysis, we wanted to encompass as many of the historical heat waves as we could to do a comparison with what was happening in 1995. And much of the Midwest, the Dust Bowl era of the 1930s was the set the previous records for heat. So one of the things I was interested in, how did the 1995 heat wave compare with some of those historical heat waves from the 1930s? And the answer basically was that the 1995 heat wave was of similar intensity, and in some metrics like dew point temperature, even more severe. So it was indeed one of the big heat events of the 20th century. And therein lies the reason why it had such major impacts on society.
What are some of the open questions? Like, what don't we know about heat waves?
I mean, there's probably some details that we would like to know more about. The fact that the humidity was so high in this particular heat wave was one of the things we investigated in some detail, because it wasn't obvious from all the data why the dew point temperature should be approaching and exceeding 80 degrees. And we found that one of the reasons was that, number one, there was a very intense inversion that developed as part of this heat wave. And this trapped the air near the surface at the same time that the crops growing were transpiring water vapor. And we believe that that was a major reason why we set records for dew point temperature. That is, crops essentially breathing and releasing water vapor, and this water vapor from the crops being trapped by this very strong inversion. And I think that's one of the things that it's not clear to me that our forecast models can capture this accurately. And that's maybe one of the areas where we could improve in the future.
And for our listeners, can you define an inversion?
An inversion is a situation in which there's very, very warm air sitting on top of slightly cooler air. Now, in the summertime, everything's warm, but the air at some distance above the ground is much warmer. And in this case, this inversion layer, much warmer air, was only about maybe a couple thousand feet above the surface. And so everything that was evaporating and transpiring from the crops was trapped in this layer of only about 2,000 feet thick. And it essentially couldn't go up. It couldn't be diluted in any way. It just kept increasing the dew point temperature.
Well, thank you so much, Ken. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Ken is a weather and climate scientist at North Carolina Institute for Climate Studies, who studied the July 1995 heat wave. You're listening to Weather Realness, the podcast all about weather and climate in Illinois. Have a question about the weather or climate for us? Leave a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu. Coming up next, we'll be talking about heat and the changing climate. Stay tuned.